5 years after the death of Sandra Bland, how much has changed and how much has not? That story and much more on today's edition of the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown, a conversation with two top Texas lawmakers on the changes to criminal justice in Texas since the death of Sandra Bland and what more needs to be done. Also, how Texas colleges and universities are trying to address changes in student visa rules, and as organizers push for greater Latino representation at the polls, a parallel initiative to preserve the history of one of the groups that led the push. That and more when the Texas Standard gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 13th day of July, 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. 5 years ago today, a 28-year-old black woman was found hanged in a Waller County jail cell after acknowledging to jail officials she had previously attempted suicide. Sandra Bland should have been moving into a new apartment in Prairie View where she landed a new job. Instead, she was stopped by a Texas DPS trooper for failing to use her turn signal. For most people, the traffic stop would have resulted in a warning or a ticket. But the stop quickly escalated when Trooper Brian Ensenia, who is white, demanded Bland step out of the vehicle after she refused to put out a cigarette. She was arrested on suspicion of assaulting a public servant. 3 days later, she was dead. The trooper was eventually fired for his actions during the traffic stop. And in 2017, the Texas legislature passed the Sandra Bland Act to help those people with a mental health or substance abuse history get treatment and get easier access to bond. But the author of the original bill, State Representative Garnett Coleman, a Houston Democrat who chairs the County Affairs Committee, says key provisions he wanted were left out of the final law. Joining us now is Representative Coleman and his colleague in the Texas House, Representative Nicole Collier, a Democrat from Fort Worth who chairs the Criminal Jurisprudence Committee. Thank you both for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Representative Coleman, I want to begin with you, if I can. One provision that did not make it into the final version of the law was stopping what you call pretext stops. Tell us what you mean by pretext stops.
So we all know what happened in New York and their policy of stop and frisk. This is stop and frisk in a car. You don't have to have probable cause to pull someone over and then ask for a consensual search. So that happens all the time. It's akin to a fishing expedition. The person has done nothing wrong. They haven't violated a traffic law. All that is required is that the officer have reasonable suspicion that they may have committed a crime. And that just doesn't work for me and shouldn't work for anybody, quite frankly.
Representative Collier, you chair the Legislative Committee on Criminal Jurisprudence, and among the things you oversee, criminal law prohibition, standards, penalties. I'm thinking the Sandra Bland Act is one of those acts of great interest to you. What's missing, as you see it, from that law?
Well, just like Chairman Coleman said, the original way the bill was filed was more comprehensive, and it included many things. And this bill did go through county affairs. It did not go through criminal jurisprudence because of the wide jurisdiction of that committee. But in terms of one thing that did come back up this last session that was included in the original bill, dealt with limiting the arrest for fine-only offenses. And that's exactly mm-hmm. what happened in Sandra Bland's case. She was arrested for a minor traffic, an alleged minor traffic violation. So, you know, we want to be able to limit those types of interactions that could escalate unnecessarily. And the original Sandra Bland Act had additional training opportunities that would be in place for law enforcement. Chairman Coleman had the concept of implicit bias training. That was a key issue in this bill to help address innate characteristics, innate things that some of us don't even know that we do, mm-hmm. And to identify those characteristics and to find ways to eliminate them.
But before we even get to the point where someone finds themselves behind bars, right now we're hearing a cry from communities, a clamor for changes in the way law enforcement does its work on the streets. And what I'm curious about, and I want to stay with you for a moment, Representative Collier, what can change in the next legislative session as you see it when it comes to what happens in those interactions?
Well, you know, first off, we need to look at who we're hiring. We have to do more to be careful about the type of individuals we're hiring. You know, people will claim that it's hard to find people to apply for the position, but not everybody deserves to be a law enforcement officer. That is a position in high regard with a lot of authority. And so we need to make sure that they're hiring the right people. We got to look at the supervision of these people and being able to hold them accountable when they commit violations. We need to standardize the definition of excessive force, because what we're finding is that reporting of it is not the same, because as one department defines it, it may not be excessive force in terms of the other department. So we have so many things that we need to address. And unfortunately, because of the death of George Floyd, the appetite is there to do it at this time. And so, you know, we intend to move forward on these efforts. So hiring officers, training them, making sure that they receive appropriate training with the enough time, holding them accountable when they commit violations and hate crimes themselves. There's a wide range of policy issues that we can do to address this.
Representative Coleman, you think about that original bill that you filed and what was left out of the final version. I mean, originally the jails to ensure prisoners had access to health care while in custody, that jails would report serious incidents, including attempted and completed suicide. That all passed. What was left out?
Well, what was left out are the big things. Nicole said it very clearly, being arrested for a fine-only offense. We wanted to end pretext stops. We wanted to end voluntary searches of an individual because they are coerced to have that search. We wanted to end a lot of things that end up creating bad interactions with police. We actually did a lot of good things. We passed de-escalation training, so police are taught to calm down a situation, which is exactly what Officer Insignia didn't do. He actually incited the situation. We know that there are many things that can be done. So those things didn't make it into the final bill, but the bill was not bad. Now, we have a different situation with George Floyd than was exactly the situation with Sandra Bland. And what local police departments can do is they can do this by policy or ordinance. So we hope that they'll go and do as much as they can in those cities and counties to adopt the types of things that we would like to see, like citizens review commissions with subpoena power, those types of things that are comprehensive when we look at criminal justice reform. But again, if we couldn't get implicit, we now have implicit bias training. I asked T. Cole to put that in place, Texas Commission on Law Enforcement, and they are doing so even without the statute. So there are things that we can do. But we want to adopt some of the things that cities adopt, and they're first out of the chute.
I want to give you both an opportunity to if there's something that you'd like to mention that we haven't touched on here. Obviously, this is a conversation that's going to be continuing. And as we think about, you know, 5 years after the death of Sandra Bland, what else would you add to the discussion, or what else do you think should be part of the discussion?
So this is what I'll add to the discussion. In 1930, Terry stops, which are pretext stops, were allowed. That hasn't changed since 1930 or 33. That tells you how long people have been working on these fundamental issues.
Absolutely. And that just shows that it's time for progress. You know, so another thing that I'd like to focus our attention on is the sentencing. There has been a wide variety of sentencing when it comes down to comparing Black and brown people to their other racial counterparts. I want us to expose this. You know, are African Americans sentenced to lengthier sentences as opposed to their white counterparts? And that would also allow us to understand and see the culture or biases in the judicial system. And discretionary charges, you know, the power, the discretionary power of our district attorneys, they don't have to charge everyone with everything, anything, you know, they don't have to charge anyone with everything. And then also in terms of our other member, Lorraine Bearable, has indicated that she wants to pick up on some things that Chair Coleman has already started by creating a see something, say something bill that would require fellow law enforcement officers to report misconduct or violations of their policy. So these are, you know, just a few things that we're doing, and the Texas Legislative Black Caucus is taking the time to listen to the community about the concerns. And that issue about what Chairman Coleman said about the Community Oversight Board with subpoena power is a top priority, an issue for our community.
Representative Nicole Collier is a Democrat from Fort Worth and chair of the House Committee on Criminal Jurisprudence. We've also heard from Representative Garnett Coleman, who is a Democrat from Houston, who chairs the County Affairs Committee. Thanks to you both for speaking with us on the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having us.
Michael Marks in for Wells Dunbar, monitoring social media across the Lone Star State on this Monday. Welcome back, Michael.
Thanks, David. An update on the coronavirus pandemic here in Texas. U.S. Army personnel supposed to arrive in Houston today, per the Houston Chronicle, to help provide more medical resources for the city. Those have been stretched thin by COVID-19. At the same time, Houston leaders like Mayor Sylvester Turner and Harris County Judge Lena Hidalgo want to shut the city down again for 2 weeks to give the hospitals some relief. Over on the Texas Standard Facebook page, Amy McShane says she's definitely in support of a shutdown, but I believe 2 weeks will not be long enough to reverse course. Likewise, Camille Kane writes, 2 weeks will only put a dent in it. If we're going to go there, let's be sure to get it right. Jeremy Kripe believes it may be too little too late. And in Houston, Twitter user Mad Max says that a 10-week complete shutdown is what's really needed. Might be fine for folks who can work from home, but the trouble, of course, is those who can't. And of course, this is an order that has to come from the governor's office, not locally, remember.
Yeah, absolutely. It's New York Times characterizes it as a bleak outlook, not just in Texas, but across the U.S. as coronavirus cases rise in some 39 states, some of the country's biggest cities, seeing out-of-control growth. We continue to monitor this story and others across the Lone Star State. Let us know what's on your news radar at Texas Standard. Michael Marks, back in 35.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Tech University's online school program, TTU K-12, offering fully online courses for kindergarten through 12th grade to start anytime from anywhere. Learn more by searching TTU K-12.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Each election year, the Latino vote gets a lot of attention in Texas, and that's happening again in this presidential cycle. Over the past several decades, many groups have worked against the odds to organize the vote, including LULAC and the Mexican American Youth Organization. But now there's an effort to preserve the origins and history of another important voting rights group. Texas Public Radio's Norma Martinez has more on the history and legacy of the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project.
The SVREP was established in 1974 in San Antonio. It grew to be the largest and oldest nonpartisan Latino voter participation organization in the U.S. Willie Velasquez founded the SVREP and served as its executive director and president until his death at age 44. He and other members of the organization had the foresight to save just about everything associated with the SVREP, pamphlets, posters, photos, and audio and video recordings. Boxes of these materials had lingered in a San Antonio storage facility until the University of Texas at San Antonio took interest in 2015. Amy Rushing, head of UTSA Special Collections, says the SVREP kept the records in good condition.
When we opened a box, we could see what years the files were from. So that helped a lot. And I mean, it was still a huge process to get the collection organized.
Rushing says it's of significant size.
It's around 430 linear feet, which translates to about 430 boxes and 550 redistricting maps. So it's very large.
Moira McKay is a public services and outreach archivist with UTSA Special Collections. She shows me the SVREP's founding papers, its Articles of Incorporation from 1974. She says Willie Velasquez had been on the FBI blacklist and had to wait several years until he could apply for the nonprofit designation.
That's when it came about in 1974, when they opened their first national site. We have that and a number of boxes of board meetings.
Which are not the most exciting things to read through, but it's all for historical perspective.
Yes, absolutely. They can be very useful for researchers, especially with details on specific people and cases.
Other items in the collection include public service announcements in English and Spanish.
Hi, this is Jose Feliciano. Did you know that in the last general election, only half of the eligible voters went out to the polls?
The collection also includes a scrapbook of newspaper articles from Willie Velasquez's funeral service in 1988. The photos prominently feature then-Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis delivering the eulogy. The records in the collection cover two decades of SVREP history through 1994. Amy Rushing, head of UTSA Special Collections, anticipates more material in the future, as the organization is still very much active in mobilizing the Latino vote. Rushing says the collection is important to share with UTSA students and the greater community so they can learn the lessons of history.
Well, I think it's important to be able to see where we've been, where we're going, and to see firsthand documentation of the struggles over the years, and to see how they dealt with these problems and how they worked to overcome them. Voter registration is still an issue today, so it's important to be able to go back and see how did they do this.
The Southwest Voter Registration Education Project is stored at the UTSA Library's Special Collection in San Antonio. I'm Norma Martinez in San Antonio.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. More pandemic fallout for energy producers. Last week, Royal Dutch Shell announced it would be idling a unit at a Houston area refinery. Reuters reports that Shell will be shutting down a sulfur recovery unit at its Deer Park facility until 2021. It's one of the latest refineries to shut down, part of its operations at least, to deal with cratering demand. Refinery workers are also left in a tough spot right now between layoffs and now COVID-19 outbreaks among the workforce. Here with more Energy Insider Matt Smith. He's Director of Commodity Research at Clipper Data. Matt, welcome back.
Thank you, David.
We're hearing about refining units sitting idle, and that's in Texas and beyond. What is the situation with refining capacity right now? I know it's pretty much been, we've had a lot of capacity, but just not a lot of demand.
Yeah, so total U.S. refinery utilization has rebounded from multi-year lows that we saw in April. We're around 67%, something like that, and now we're above 77%. But that is still considerably lagging the usual pace of activity of refineries. The utilization rate at this time of year is typically around 95% as refineries gear up to meet the peak of summer driving season and all that demand spurred on by summer road trips. We are seeing a similar trending in refining activity on the U.S. Gulf, where about 45% of total U.S. refining capacity is. It is rebounding from April lows, but still shy, well shy of year-ago levels. And so there is that theme of rebounding, but not to where we were.
Let me just ask a Duhay question here, because I think a lot of people listening may think, okay, well, wait a minute. I know that Texas has, at least in physical terms, we have a lot of refineries. But when we talk about refining capacity, are we talking about just the infrastructure, or are we talking about the ability to start processing that raw oil? I mean, what is it? What do we mean by refining capacity?
So a refinery can run full tilt And if it is doing that, it is running at 100% of its capacity, 100% of utilization. And so if we take a look at the US Gulf Coast and we see that it's running at around, 80%, something like that, that means, 4/5 of that utilization is being used and 20% of it is not.
I see. And right now, if you were to break it down in percentage terms, sorry, I don't mean to throw you a curveball here, but roughly what are we looking at here in Texas?
It's around that kind of 80% mark, which sounds pretty high, but yeah, compared to what it typically is, it's normally running about 95%, something like that, going absolute gung-ho to produce all this gasoline for the peak of summer driving season. But because demand has been stymied somewhat, yes, it has come back, but it's still not where it typically is. That's why these refineries aren't running as hard.
Well, what about the impact on staff at these refineries? Does it take a large team to run them?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's another issue as well, David. And so not only are these refineries getting hit by lower demand, but they're also being impacted by rising COVID cases as well in Texas. So a number of refineries on the U.S. Gulf Coast have workers who have tested positive for the coronavirus. Again, it goes back to that kind of issue in terms of social distancing. You have a number of refineries that are in turnaround, which is essentially maintenance. And you have large groups going into these refineries, contractors, and getting this work done. But, they're all operating in close conditions. And this has caused multiple outbreaks of coronavirus across the refineries, too.
So even if you did see a major increase in demand, you might have staffing issues that would keep that supply from happening.
That's definitely another element that has to be considered. Yeah, we could see that happening too.
Matt Smith is Director of Commodity Research at Clipper Data. He joins us every couple of weeks to give us an update on the energy industry. Matt, good to talk with you again, sir. Thanks so much.
You too. Thanks, David.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. The Texas Supreme Court has denied the state Republican Party's request to allow its in-person convention to proceed in Houston this week. The ruling today validates the venue operator's contractual right to cancel the event due to the coronavirus outbreak. Houston's mayor called for the cancellation. The court's decision says the Republican Party's constitutional rights to engage in electoral activities do not allow it to simply commandeer the George R. Brown Convention Center. The Texas GOP originally scheduled the event for May, but postponed due to the public health crisis. More members of an Army medical team are expected to arrive in San Antonio today to help local hospitals respond to the surge in COVID-19 cases. Texas Public Radio's Carson Frame has more.
As the coronavirus caseload continues its rapid climb in Bexar County, the last members of an 85-person Army medical team are embedding with 5 area hospitals. The team is mostly made up of nurses and respiratory specialists. Other parts of Texas will soon receive similar help. In recent days, U.S. Northern Command announced that nearly 500 more Defense Department medical personnel had been assigned to the state, but officials are still deciding where to place some of them. Federal assessment teams have been sent to Dallas, Houston, Austin, San Antonio, McAllen, and Laredo to determine the areas of greatest need and how best to augment the trauma and emergency health care systems in each region. A spokesman for U.S. Army North said the next 85-person Army team would head to Houston. I'm Carson Frame in San Antonio.
New research out of Texas A&M University shows white police officers are more likely to be aggressive with civilians than black officers. Houston Public Media's Elizabeth Troval has more on the study, which analyzed 911 data in 2 U.S. cities.
The Texas A&M study found white officers in the 2 cities used physical force 60% more than black officers and fired their guns twice as often. The data showed not only are white officers more aggressive in general, when policing in black neighborhoods, they are more likely to be violent. Economics professor Mark Hoekstra authored the study.
While white and black officers use force with a gun at the same rates in white neighborhoods, white cops are 5 times as likely to use force with a gun in Black neighborhoods.
The research also shows both Black and Hispanic civilians are more likely to experience police violence than whites. Hoekstra looked at more than 2 million 911 calls in the two cities. The research agreement prevents him from revealing which cities were used for the study. I'm Elizabeth Trovall in Houston.
And I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
As communities grapple with the coronavirus pandemic, new developments unfold continuously. Catch up on the day's news from around the world and across Texas by listening to All Things Considered, weekday afternoons on your local NPR station.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. A federal judge in Los Angeles has ruled that Federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement has until this Friday, July 17th, to release migrant children in family detention because of COVID-19 concerns. Immigrant rights activists welcome that decision, but they also worry this could lead to another round of family separations. Texas Public Radio's Reynaldo Leanos Jr. reports.
Judge Dolly G of the U.S. District Court for the Central District of California released an order at the end of June saying that the court was not surprised that COVID-19 had reached two family detention centers in Texas, something health professionals had warned all along. The order also said there was no time for half measures and that these centers are on fire.
And indeed, the house is on fire. There are already, to our knowledge, five individuals who work at the South Texas Family Residential Center in Dilley who have tested positive for COVID-19.
That's Shaylin Fluharty. She's with Proyecto Dilley. They provide legal services to detained asylum-seeking mothers and their children at the Family Detention Center in Dilley. She says at least 11 people, including mothers and children, have tested positive for COVID-19 at the Family Detention Center in Karnes City.
And we are seeing now what we have always feared, which is that we would risk the lives of children and their parents for no other reason than, you know, locking them up, even though they're in the United States seeking protection from harm.
Judge G gave ICE until July 17 to either release children from these facilities to sponsors or release the children with their parents. But here's where it gets tricky. G oversees something called the Flores Settlement Agreement. It sets conditions under which the government can detain immigrant children. It doesn't apply to adults, but human rights advocates say ICE does have the ability to release the families together. Here's Kenji Kazuka with Human Rights First.
All along, the government has had the authority to release families, children and parents together, under existing parole authority under the law and under the regulations. They're choosing not to release those families.
Back in May, ICE called some parents in its custody into rooms and presented them with what advocates call a binary choice. Fluharty says ICE asked parents if they wanted their children to be released to a sponsor or remain indefinitely detained with them.
And that question in and of itself sent our parents and children spiraling. I mean, there are stories of children who for days were crying nonstop in the facility because they thought that they were going to be separated from their moms.
ICE says at the end of April, the U.S. District Court for the Central District of California issued an order that directed them to promptly and safely release minors from family detention. The agency says they checked in with the minors and their parents to make individual parole determinations. ICE says it interviewed nearly 300 individuals and used a form that was developed almost 3 years ago to comply with that order. That's a mother who says she's been detained at the Dilley facility with her daughter for about 10 months. She didn't want her name used because she fears speaking out will get her and her daughter in trouble with ICE. She says ICE wanted her to sign a document back in May asking if she wanted her daughter released with a sponsor or remain in detention with her. She says the recent news about Judge G's order has her really worried because she doesn't want to be separated from her daughter and hopes ICE releases them together because her daughter has asthma and respiratory issues. Here's Fluharty with Proyecto Dilley again.
But this looming question of whether or not children will once again be ripped apart from their parents is a question that everyone should be up at night thinking about. And certainly there is no one who is feeling more alarmed, panicked, or more anxiety than both the parents and the children that we represent.
Acting Secretary for the Department of Homeland Security, Chad Wolf, appeared on Fox News Monday. He said the latest order to release migrant children from detention is one of a number of court cases they're dealing with, and they have no plans of any mass release of migrants.
But at the end of the day, we're not, as some courts have asked us to do and some activists have asked us to do, is to let everyone out of ICE detention facilities. That's about 25,000 folks. We're not going to do a jailbreak. That's not what we do.
ICE says it's currently reviewing Judge G's order. The agency says it recently completed voluntary COVID-19 tests for all 278 immigrants detained at the three family detention centers across the country, and that the results came back negative, except for 14 people at the facility in Karn City. I'm Reynaldo Leanos Jr. in Mission.
New visa rules say higher ed students can't stay in the U.S. if their coursework is all online. As those rules are being challenged, how are Texas universities responding? A discussion next as the Texas Standard continues, coming up on 39 minutes past the hour.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, welcoming visitors back to the historic beach town while keeping safety in mind. Shopping, Gulf seafood, and family attractions like Moody Gardens and more. Details at galveston.com.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. A rule recently announced by Immigration and Customs Enforcement says international students cannot remain in the U.S. if the classes they attend at universities here went online only in the fall. The move by the Trump administration is currently being challenged by Harvard and MIT universities. Harvard did decide to offer only online courses for the fall semester as concern about the spread of COVID-19 in the U.S. continues. For the country's some 1 million international students, the rule change could make college plans in the fall semester uncertain at the very least. While most universities in the U.S. will be offering either in-person or a hybrid of online and in-person classes, as we're seeing COVID-19 surge in parts of the country, this move has also been viewed by critics as an attempt to force universities to reopen campuses. To learn more about how this rule might affect some of the plans of international students at universities here in Texas, we turn to two public colleges, Texas State University and the University of Houston. Joining us is Rosario Davis. She is the Assistant Vice President and Director of International Affairs at Texas State University. Ms. Davis, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you, David.
And we have Dan Maxwell joining us. He's the Associate Vice Chancellor for Student Affairs at the University of Houston. Mr. Maxwell, welcome.
Great to be here.
First, Ms. Davis, let's start with you. On average, how many international students attend Texas State each year?
We have, on average, 550 international students at Texas State University.
550. And Mr. Maxwell, what about University of Houston?
This year, we're expecting around 2,300.
All right. Well, let me first go to Texas State. Ms. Davis, what concerns do you have about this rule?
There is a very high level of concern, both administratively and obviously on the part of our students. While we do, as you've said, have a plan to return to face-to-face in the fall, and we're able to provide students consultancy on how they will proceed under those conditions, the big concern is, what do we do if we go online? And those answers to those questions are hard.
I imagine you're dealing with the same situation there in Houston, Mr. Maxwell?
We are. We've elected to offer courses online, both synchronously and asynchronously, and then what we're calling a hyperflex, which courses will be taught, where a portion of the enrollment in those courses will be face-to-face. Our goal is to get all of our international students in at least one of our hyperflex classes so that they can have that face-to-face portion and meet the guidelines as they're currently being explained to us.
You know, it's interesting. I've seen some conversations on social media. You've had teachers, college teachers, professors come out and say, listen, sign up for my class. I'll make sure that we have some kind of in-person interaction. Are those kind of accommodations being purposefully made to try to deal with the impact of this rule? Let me ask you first at Texas State, Ms. Davis.
Well, we do have options that existed before, but certainly we are hearing and working with our enrolled students to make sure that they do have options, and we are considering creating options if they don't exist in each person's case, yes.
Mr. Maxwell, is that the sort of thing you're hearing there in Houston?
Yeah, the nice thing is our faculty have stepped up and said, how can we make this work? You know, we really are concerned that this is unfairly impacting our international students. How can we be of assistance? So currently our registrar is working with our academic colleges and seeing how the courses are being proposed to be delivered in the fall. Again, trying to figure out the percentage of online, the percentage that will be in this HyperFlex. In attempting to meet the guidelines, we want to get at least every international student in one of our HyperFlex classes where they can have that face-to-face option. So the goal is to figure out how to make that happen.
It seems as if in recent years we've seen a larger percentage of international students at Texas colleges and universities overall. And I know that's a big part when it comes to tuition and fees and that sort of thing. They're a big part of the factor in terms of maintaining the health of the university overall, irrespective of the fact that they contribute enormously to the cultural scene on campus. What I'm curious about is, how does this rule potentially impact Texas State and the University of Houston? Ms. Davis?
At Texas State, proportionally, we don't have a very large group of international students, so that the financial impact is an immediate concern. Rather, as you say, we invite international students and enjoy the presence of international students on our campus very significantly to address questions of research, to continue their education plans, to contribute to the culture of our campus. So regardless of the financial impact they have, they're extremely important to the overall environment for Texas State.
What about at University of Houston, where you have a larger number of international students who stand to be directly affected there? How do you see this, Mr. Maxwell?
Well, you know, we value the intellect that all of our students bring into the classroom, and with our international students, we're right about 7.5% of our total student population, and we're so proud to be such a diverse institution across the board with our students. And so any reduction in having international students on our campus, in our classrooms, doing research with our faculty is a disservice, I think, and they bring so much to the campus, similarly as you heard at Texas State in regards to perspective and ideas and thoughts. And so our goal is to still be a place that international students want to be at, that they value, because we prosper by having them as a part of our community.
But as I was saying earlier, this is facing a legal challenge. The word limbo comes to mind. I was thinking about the situation that a lot of these students might find themselves in personally. Can you share with us anything that you've been hearing directly from some of these students? What are they going to do? Ms. Davis?
Yes, absolutely. There are big concerns. Concerns about continuing education plans. There are students who are nearing the end of their programs, and what impact would that make should they have to suddenly leave? And that's just the beginning from the education perspective. Another question is, what about those personal arrangements that they've made to live here, mm-hmm. leases, mm-hmm. Things of this nature? We are consulting with a student attorney for students, and making sure that we're providing in town halls, in advice, in website, in email communication, and inviting each case to come forward so that we can provide guidance.
Mr. Maxwell, what are you hearing when it comes to that personal level of people struggling with the fact that they don't know what's going to happen next?
Yeah, the pandemic has initially caused many of our international students who went home just the ability to get back into the country. These new guidelines are adding another level of concern, and the students have to go back home, and it impacts their visa status. That could then prevent them from being able to have internships or working on campus or finding some post-graduation work to put into practice what they've learned. And so it's not necessarily just impacting them today. It could have a 2 to 3 year impact on just their educational experience if we're not able to figure out how to keep them on campus and meet the guidelines as they've been outlined.
That's the voice of Dan Maxwell. He's the Associate Vice Chancellor for Student Affairs at the University of Houston. We've also been speaking with Rosario Davis. She is the Assistant Vice President and Director of International Affairs at Texas State University. Thanks to you both for joining us on The Standard.
Thank you very much.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Association of Community Colleges, providing pathways for Texans to advance the individual aspirations of students while focusing on accessibility, affordability, and relevance. More at tacc.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas ABLE program, helping eligible Texans with disabilities save and plan for the future to pay for qualified disability expenses with a tax-advantaged ABLE account. Learn more at texasable.org.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Protests in the aftermath of the police killing of George Floyd have led to renewed calls for criminal justice reform and turned a spotlight on the role district attorneys play in shaping how people are prosecuted. Tomorrow's primary runoff day across Texas and in El Paso, voters will be electing their first new DA in nearly three decades. Since there's no Republican candidate, whoever wins tomorrow's Democratic runoff will take office when longtime incumbent Jaime Esparza retires. As KERA's Mallory Falk reports, the El Paso candidates are calling for some reforms, but not as many changes as some high-profile new progressive prosecutors are embracing.
Candidates for district attorney used to compete over who was the toughest on crime, but that's shifting.
Communities have grown tired of the amount of money we spend and the lives that we throw away and the families that we fracture. And communities we damage by the tough-on-crime practices.
Miriam Krinsky directs Fair and Just Prosecution, a nonprofit that works with newly elected, reform-minded prosecutors across the country.
Communities are demanding a different starting point.
That includes ones in Texas. In the last few years, self-described reformers have won DA elections in places like Dallas, Bear, and Nueces counties. Krinsky says more and more DA candidates are talking about how policing and the criminal justice system are plagued by inequality and in need of a massive overhaul. In the runoff that'll decide El Paso's new DA, the candidates' messages are more moderate. Here's private attorney Yvonne Rosales, who got just over 38% of the vote in March at a recent forum on policing.
I don't think that El Paso is a community that has a lot of racial tension issues as there are going on in many of the other cities across the nation.
And here's Assistant District Attorney James Montoya, who's running for his boss's seat.
Do I think that El Paso is in need of radical or wide-ranging changes? My answer is no.
He got 34% of the vote in March. Both Montoya and Rosales say, as DA, they'd want to put fewer people behind bars, but neither is calling for large-scale systemic transformation. Montoya says the U.S. probably locks up too many people.
But I will tell you, here in El Paso, this is not a county, this is not a criminal justice system here that is excessively punitive. You know, our incarceration rate is quite low compared to both the state and national average.
Still, he says he'd like his office to put fewer resources toward prosecuting certain nonviolent offenses and, in particular, cut down on low-level marijuana charges. Criminal justice experts say marijuana enforcement disproportionately affects people of color. But Montoya says he wouldn't decline these cases altogether.
And I know that there have been other jurisdictions that have done that, can say, I am no longer prosecuting any marijuana case, and de facto, you know, decriminalization. I don't feel comfortable at this point being a one-man mini legislature.
Yvonne Rosales takes a similar stance on misdemeanor marijuana charges.
We need to look at it on a case-by-case basis.
Both candidates say they'll bring more transparency to the DA's office by creating a public integrity unit. Rosales also wants a unit focused on wrongful convictions, and both say they'd address mental health.
I wanted to try to avoid criminalizing nonviolent offenders who have mental health issues.
That the El Paso County Jail is the largest mental health treatment facility in the county, to me, says that we're doing something wrong.
Critics of the criminal justice system in El Paso say the DA's office needs more change.
It seems to me like, you know, they take one step when they should take five.
That's Joe Moody, a Democrat who represents El Paso in the Texas House. Moody helped launch a criminal justice reform caucus in the state legislature and even thought about running for DA himself.
We have this moniker as a safe city, and we are. So people don't think about the criminal justice system in as critical a way as they would in other communities. And I think it's been given a free pass.
Moody points out, if you're a 50-year-old El Pasoan, there have only been two different DAs in your lifetime. Now, he says, is time for the region to think big.
When we make reforms around the edges, they don't really cut to the core of the problem.
Ultimately, whoever's the next DA, Montoya or Rosales, won't just be tasked with deciding how much to shake up the office. They'll prosecute the biggest case in El Paso's history, against a North Texas man accused of killing 23 people at a local Walmart, the deadliest attack on Latinos in modern U.S. history. I'm Mallory Falk in El Paso.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Joining us once again is, it's Michael Marks in for Wells Dunbar. He's monitoring social media across the Lone Star State. I'm so used to saying Wells Dunbar, just sort of rolls off the tongue. But, yeah, of course, glad you could join us today.
We were on the precipice there, David. We were very close to a, a Wells instead of a Michael.
Yes,
no worries.
True.
It is me. Wanted to mention this news breaking before the show. The Texas Republican Convention, we covered this last week, was scheduled to happen in Houston this week. That is before the city canceled its contract with the GOP because of the coronavirus. Party officials and activists tried to challenge that decision in court. That failed, and as of this morning, so did its appeal to the Texas Supreme Court. So the convention will either need to happen virtually, or the party will have to find another venue to hold it in person. GOP party chairman James Dickey said that contingency plans are being finalized. Speaking of in person or no, David, another thing Texans are talking about, going back to school. Mm-hmm. I know that's a topic that the show is going to take up in greater depth in the coming weeks. But at the moment, we're 4 weeks away from the scheduled start of the fall semester. The Texas Education Agency has mandated that schools offer in-person classes, although families may choose for kids to attend virtually. But a lot of conversation in Texas homes and on the Texas Standard Facebook page. This message from Maddie Burney. She works for Riesel ISD in Central Texas and writes, "We can't even keep COVID from spreading during summer practices and strength and conditioning training, a lot of which are outside. How is it going to look with 25 to 30 students in a classroom and 100 in the halls? I want to be back in my classroom. I really do. But I want all to be safe and healthy. I know parents have to work and all the other arguments. It's all a hot mess right now. Not everyone is going to be happy with whatever happens. That much is assured." Janice Spinks also has some concerns about the logistics of making social distance protocols work in schools. She said no child is going to be able to keep a mask on all day long, and trying to get them to obey the rules of sanitation while still trying to do all the other things teachers have to do over the course of a day is an impossible task. The virus is going to touch everyone at some point. It really isn't so much a matter of stopping it as it is controlling the burn. How can it be a good idea to send children back to school when the virus is on the rise? Of course, the flip side of that, of course, David, like we've had at the end of the spring semester, what happens to families who aren't in a position just to keep kids at home indefinitely?
Right. Absolutely.
It's a pickle that, we're certainly going to be discussing.
It is definitely a tough one, and it is indeed one of those stories we continue to track here at The Standard. An update to a story we were just talking about while we were on the air. We learned 17 states in the District of Columbia have now sued the Trump administration to block that new rule that would revoke the visas of international students who take classes entirely online in the fall. You can keep up with the news 24/7 at texasstandard.org, and of course, we hope you will join us again tomorrow.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.